You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello there and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Tighe Enright. On today's show, cutting carbon emissions at the climate change conference in Paris. But is it more of the usual hot air? That topic and others will be under discussion with Peter Fleming, a professor of business and society at Cass Business School here in London, and with the author and broadcaster Michael Goldfarb. We'll also have a distinct Russian theme throughout the programme, with NATO reaching out to Montenegro. We'll ask if this is the wisest step when Western relations with Moscow are at their most delicate in a generation. And what will it take to defuse its feud with Turkey over the downing of one of its military jets? Then we'll turn to Thailand, where its military junta's censorship was clear to see on today's International New York Times. Its Thai edition left a blank space in the front page in lieu of an article talking about a deteriorating quality of life in the country whose democracy has been suspended. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Tighe Enright. So welcome indeed to the programme. Welcome to our guests today, Peter Fleming and Michael Goldfarb. Peter is a professor of business and society at Cass Business School, and Michael Goldfarb, an author and broadcaster for Politico.eu. Let's start the programme straight away in Paris with the latest round of the International Climate Treaty Change negotiations. We're getting underway in earnest today. This obviously after the world leaders gathered yesterday evening to deliver their moving opening speeches, very deep in rhetoric. This time around, I suppose, unlike the last attempt in Copenhagen, we're told there's lots of optimism that legally binding targets can actually be agreed upon. And probably the most interesting news line really came out of India's Narendra Modi, who announced an alliance of 120 countries to promote solar power. And I don't know about you, gents, I'm terribly cynical about these climate change conferences and what they actually achieve. But let's focus on the positives for a moment, because I was quite interested in what Narendra Modi initiated, this solar allowance. What's your read, Peter, as to what it actually means and what it could achieve?
I think it's trying to create alliances and relationships in an environment that has been, you know, I think you're right to be cynical, rather depressing track record for coming out with meaningful policies and agreements or treaties, given that, you know, that two degrees target doesn't look like we're going to hit it. So, you know, but I found that it's quite interesting that initiatives like this are trying to bypass, you know, the elephant in the room, which is unfortunately the Republican controlled Congress is really kind of dictating the terms, which is quite interesting.
It's interesting to hear Peter say that, because across a wide range of issues related to America's ability to project itself in the world at the moment, you have this big elephant in the room. And you know, if another Democrat is elected president, which is entirely possible next year, that elephant will still be in power. Mm-hmm. And so we can come to some of the other issues, like trying to solve the Syria mess, that just isn't possible, so long as the Republicans are there and their ideology seems to have been reduced to wrecking Democratic presidencies. I think, you know, they seem to be trying to do less. I can remember at the Copenhagen conference, when was that, in 2009?
2009, yeah.
Yeah, John Snow, who's a local news presenter here, and he's a man, gray-haired, tall, very English guy, even though he grew up in Africa. They built up all kinds of expectations, and he was running around the conference hall saying, 24 hours to save the world. He'd grab an international leader. What are you going to do about it? Well, we don't have that this time. I mean, we don't have that same sense of enthusiasm. That's good. In terms of the Modi question, now I have to be cynical because, you know, yes, you get 120 nations around the equator and places with lots of sun. So we can get working on developing solar energy in the way it should be developed. But, you know, he's pledged, what, £30 million to build a headquarters for this initiative.
An organization to
in India.
Coordinate efforts.
You know,
efforts,
and last year India spent £250 million on their space program. And, you know,
and also particularly reliant, a country that's particularly reliant on coal, so perhaps an effort to divert attention from
that's another thing. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about, well, who's going to pay for it? I mean, if you, the West, the developed countries who polluted the planet in the first place in your drive to economic self-sufficiency and indeed wealth, then, you know, you have to help us in the transition if you don't want us to use these fuels.
You've got to wonder, though, given the recent fall off in the price of oil and gas and the fact that it's become relatively cheaper to produce renewable energy these days, you've got to wonder, are we maybe optimistically at a bit of a tipping point in this whole thing where it actually perhaps becomes economically viable to be more reliant on renewable resources?
Well, it was a symbolic gesture by Modi, but if we look at the current infrastructure of global resources, you know, it is still pretty wedded to the same old story. And I think symbolic gestures like the one we saw today are important for at least putting it on the table. You know, it'd be fantastic if, the 300 million people without access to electricity in a country that is heavily reliant on coal just bypassed the whole fossil fuels and went straight to solar power. That would be an amazing story. So I like the gesture, but I do remain a little bit cynical. But even US President Obama come out with the renewable kind of card as well today.
Yeah. What's interesting, of course, is that aside from the inability to get anyone to agree in the amongst international leaders on, you know, some kind of workable treaty, I mean, it seems to me that the mismatch in all this is between capitalism as it's constructed globally. And, I mean, we have a clear need for different forms of energy, a clear need to have, I mean, for capitalism to coexist with a planet that's been badly degraded over the last two centuries by the growth of a capitalist global economy. That has not come up. And when the best minds, again, I'm going to be a cynic, you know, I keep thinking, you know, in Silicon Valley, you know, guys like Elon Musk are busy trying to
build electric cars.
Build electric cars, but they're also trying to fly spaceships and other things. And until you get more and more investment capital going into developing renewables, rather than relying on taxpayers in this country and that country, and particularly in the United States, where people don't want to pay taxes. Mm-hmm. You until that mismatch is settled, I think that trying to bring 170 heads of government together, it's a gesture and not necessarily an effective one.
But I suppose final thought maybe of optimism on what we're seeing happening in Paris right now. The last conference in Copenhagen didn't succeed. That was 2009. The world was in a very different place back then. They were cleaning up the mess after the economy had imploded. This time around, we're not doing fantastically well economically, but things have moved on. Perhaps there's more wriggle room, more leeway to start taxing nasty things.
I think we're seeing the beginning of geopolitical wars around oil and resources. Now I'm sounding very pessimistic. And we're seeing the fruition of 10 years of kind of warlike activity that I think is going to be marking the next 20 years.
The mood in this studio is thicker than the smog in Beijing this morning. But there we go. Let's move on to our next topic and talk about NATO, which has identified its latest potential partner in Montenegro, which is ironically a country that the alliance bombed 17 years ago. That, of course, when it was part of the former Yugoslavia and involved in the conflict in Kosovo. But NATO Secretary General has said that a lot of water has gone under the bridge since then, and a formal invitation is expected to be made tomorrow. Foreign ministers of countries in the NATO alliance meeting today, but that invitation expected to be made tomorrow. I suppose there could be a lot of questions over the timing of this, couldn't there? But I suppose NATO's constitution actually says it has to accept members who are interested and willing in joining up. I suppose, though, the timing could have been better, though, couldn't it?
Well, it could have been better, especially at a moment when, you know, NATO, and when we say NATO, we mean, we should emphasize that NATO is very much U.S. dominated. And the U.S. needs to work with Russia on a wide range of issues. NATO is also engaged in a tense situation still over Ukraine, although much of the international focus now is on Russia's involvement in Syria. But having said that, it's different than the other possible joinee of NATO, which is Georgia, and which sits right on the border with Russia. If you look at the map, you have Greece, and then you have Montenegro, and then Albania. Albania and Greece are in, or is it vice versa? I can never remember. Anyway, we're talking about the eastern shores of the Adriatic coast, and it will just be a single membership bloc, because Croatia is a member now, and Greece, and Albania. So in some respects, it's just filling in the last piece of the jigsaw puzzle, and it is as far southwest in the Slavic world as you can get from Russia. I think it'll end up queuing, huffing and puffing, but there are much, much more important things to be discussed between the US and Russia, or NATO and Russia, for that matter.
There certainly are, but I mean, let's talk more. You raised the point about Georgia. Montenegro is not Georgia, but then Georgia probably has an awful lot more in common with Ukraine. And I suppose if there were a deepening or extended further towards Georgia, that could really upset the cards.
It would be quite an amazing, this was called provocative, but that would truly be provocative given the situation around the area. And the next story we're going to talk about in terms of Syria, lots of happy stories tonight, I see. Mm. I think if it's the step in the expansion. You know, I remember reading a book when I was in my undergrad, you know, Francis Fukuyama's The End of History. He said NATO, it's an institution that's over. It's a vestige of a Cold War. I'm just amazed how all of these kind of roles have just sprung up over the last 5 years with Putin, and it's quite astounding.
Yeah, it was easy for Francis Fukuyama. Do you know how many times when there was 3.5 minutes of dead air on National Public Radio, and I was the London correspondent, I would be asked to, can you do a Wither NATO piece?
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. In the end, it became necessary because we this 3 years after Fukuyama published his book, we were Europe was deeply involved with the Bosnian Civil War, and in the end, it was NATO as an institution, although it was mostly American pilots, that brought an end to that war by finally bombing the Serbs off the heights around Sarajevo, and so it exists. It's an alliance that, for all it has not been called upon, thankfully, in its existence, is actually an institution that has survived, although, like all of these institutions created after World War II, it is showing its age and rust.
But clearly showing its, potency in the fact that Moscow is so opposed to its expansion, and along with Montenegro's invitation tomorrow, the ministers are expected to reiterate their open-door policy towards Georgia. But let's just talk about Montenegro's bid to join. I mean, you have to wonder if the mood behind it has been accelerated by Russia's provocative behavior amongst other countries in its neighborhood.
There's certainly been a lot of agitation around that, and the timing, I think, as Michael mentioned, is it's not a coincidence, and it's an escalation, isn't it? It's an escalation of the tensions. It's people taking sides, really. It's like a schoolyard fight,
Good way of putting it.
I'm taking this side rather than your side. And one wonders how, as this gets more and more escalated, how to diffuse it.
Well, talking of setting differences aside with Russia, and it's something we're going to be touching on in our next topic, but this probably bears more relation to this particular topic. Given recent developments involving ISIS and the downing of the Russian plane over Egypt, or having left Egypt, and of course the attacks in Paris, do you get the sense that maybe Russia-Western relations are at the beginning of an upwards curve now, given that there's a newfound common enemy in ISIS?
I don't think it's binary, and I don't think, and I've yet to see any substantive reporting from Syria that Russia's actually engaged in fighting ISIS. Russia is essentially protecting its client.
But if they weren't before, they quite likely will be now. Would you think?
I don't know. It is so confusing. And I think that, in a better world, you could set up spheres of, you'd have, operational, if not co-command, at least an operational set of relations between Russia, which is in the skies and has paid the price. Well, you know, we'll come on to it about, you know, with its jet being shot down for its 15-second, you know, cross through that little salient of Turkey that drops down into towards ISIS. You know, I just think that there's no binary solutions in the world
at the moment for anything. Is there a bridge, though, Peter Fleming, being built perhaps in Paris and François Hollande's attempt to build a kind of a global alliance against ISIS?
Well, maybe. And, you know, here in the UK, Michael and I were talking about this earlier, you know, an important debate regarding the role of another major power in the fight against ISIS. But perhaps, so it would be interesting if the history books look at Paris, if they do at all, to see that as a galvanizing point in which we have disparate parties coming together. But I think Michael's right, you know, it's a case of my friend's enemy is also my friend, you know, and that makes things very, very difficult to sort out.
Yeah, all decisions are tactical. This week, you know, Peter and I are friends, you know, and then, you know, we get our problems sorted and then we can go back to our usual antipathies, you know.
There we go. Let's park our antipathies for a moment. We're going to take a short break. You are listening to Midori House. I'm Ty Genreich, joined by my guests, Peter Fleming and Michael Goldfarb. Coming up after this short break, the Turkish-Russia saga continues and Thailand refuses to print the International New York Times once again. Stay tuned.
The Monaco Minute is our daily email bulletin covering all the topics we're passionate about, from global affairs to retail news, finance to urbanism, architecture to transport. Packed with opinions and reports from around the globe, it's a unique briefing on the day from our editors and correspondents. Go to monocle.com to sign up for free today, and we'll send you the Monocle Minute to your inbox every weekday and deliver you a special weekend edition, which brings you the best in hospitality, retail, food and drink, and culture. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world every day of the week.
Who are the young designers you should be looking out for? Who's leading the way when it comes to architecture, fashion, product, and interior design? And what lessons from design history should we all be taking note of?
He really was an artist whose medium of expression was fashion.
I could never live in a place that I designed because I'm not designing for myself.
You look for where there is a potential for creativity, for poetry. So architectural lighting, where the dialogue with architecture can become something very interesting.
Monocle 24's design program Section D delves deep into the places, communities, and manufacturers that make the design industry what it is. From trade shows to trend forecasts, tune in every Tuesday and make Section D the object of your attention.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. I'm Tig Enright and I'm still joined by my guests for the day, Peter Fleming and Michael Goldfarb. We're going to continue our Russian theme now by examining the shattered state of its relations with Turkey. Yesterday, the US President Barack Obama urged both countries to end their spat over the shooting down of a Russian warplane by the Turkish military. That happened last week. Barack Obama stressed that their focus should be on the common enemy in the form of ISIS. Vladimir Putin, though, is not so certain that is a common enemy. Today, he added another point to the saga, suggesting that Turkey's decision to shoot down one of his planes was dictated by their desire to protect an oil supply to Turkish territories, which is being supplied by ISIS. So in summary, what Moscow is saying is that Turkey is getting cheap oil from ISIS and is seeking their protection. First of all, what's your read about this claim?
Clearly, Vladimir Putin needs more sleep. Apparently, he's not sleeping much these days.
God bless him.
Because Turkey gets most of its resources from Russia, so it kind of doesn't make sense that they would rely upon ISIS for an oil supply. Having said that, there's always been a black market between Syria and Turkey, and there has been, or a grey market is perhaps more accurate. And I guess now it's playing an important role, given that Russia's going in bombing not ISIS, but
Free Syrian Army, and
exactly,
and everybody who's actually in the field against Assad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting. A story popped up. You can't read the press anymore, just as the press. And especially since we all filter the press through our social networks. So something popped up the other day that, pointing out that claiming that Erdogan's son, I think his name is Bilal, don't quote me on his first name, is involved in this trade. And then 2 days later, you get Putin saying this, and you suddenly think, oh my God, that story about Erdogan's son being up to his thighs in smuggled oil, and that, maybe that story came from Russia, because that's the way things work. The first time I went into Kurdistan was in 1996, sanctions against Saddam. I went in through Turkey because you couldn't get in any other way. The queue of empty tankers was easily 5 miles long. And they went in, they loaded up, they drove back into Turkey. These are well-established supply routes. When I was there in September, I wrote a piece and asked why, because you could bomb all these trucks off the road. Why aren't they doing this? And that is a question that needs to be answered both by the United States and to a degree by Turkey. But I mean, Putin is way off the map here. And it's insane because he's got the southern route of oil and natural gas coming out of Russia. Sanctions have stopped the northern route. And, you know, he's only cutting off his nose to spite his face. But, you know, this is rhetoric. And can we all remember back a year when Erdogan and Putin were seen as being the new kind of leader in the world? You know, that they were elected freely and would be elected over and over again, even as they created themselves into dictatorial power. And now these two guys are having at each other.
And I thought what was interesting, you know, is not necessarily, and I think, you know, as you say, it's a ridiculous statement, but, ISIS kind of closely watching world oil prices. Like, it just didn't fit the kind of the nihilistic death cult image I had of them. And I think that...
Well, everyone's got to watch the bottom line, haven't they?
No, exactly. Yeah. And they're keenly interested.
Yeah. I mean, it's often been, talking of grey areas, it's a bit of grey area, just what Turkey is really doing in Syria or with our willingness to help. And last week, I believe, two Turkish journalists were arrested because they wrote a story about Turkish intelligence trucks providing weapons to rebel groups in Syria. I suppose on our side of the argument in the West, that seems to us like Turkey's doing a good thing, but perhaps not in Moscow, given that these rebel groups are their stated enemies.
The longer these conflicts go on, the more congested and confused the interactions, particularly of security and spy services. I mean, in Northern Ireland, after 20 years of small-scale civil war, the British security forces, you know, practically were on the IRA Army Council. You know, they knew what was going on, but you couldn't act against things half the time because you might expose one of your assets. Mm. And I think that's happened at a great pace along the Turkish-Syrian border. It is, however, porous. If Turkey was very serious about stopping ISIS, they could do that and stop it. But then, you know, what would happen is they'd block the border, and for every ISIS person turned back, you would have, you know, 50 families desperately trying to get to some kind of safety in a refugee camp being forced to stay in Syria, and we'd all be screaming about that.
Do you know, we started this conversation talking about the jet and specifically about Turkey-Russia relations. Let's bring it back there. And I just wonder, you know, it's only last week since this actually happened. Is this a case of Moscow and Ankara grandstanding, but not really doing much substantive until it fades in the memory of their publics back home?
Well, shooting down a jet is an over the top sort of thing to do, you know, especially as it is a small, you know, peninsula.
But it's done now. So where to from now?
Mm. Well, that's a very good question. I think that basically it will just fade into memory. I think unless so many planes are dropping out of the sky at the moment, one's afraid to fly. It will just be another item on a long litany of similar catastrophes, and it will blend into the whole. I'm sounding very pessimistic again, aren't I? I should lighten things up, but it will just blend into the whole kind of infrastructure of the event.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, look, they have to posture both men for their domestic political consumption. And eventually people will forget, although perhaps they'll be a bit more careful, crossing Turkish airspace or just up there in the unfriendly skies over Syria, which are extremely crowded because you've got French planes going this way, you've got American planes. And apparently Russia's even lobbing the occasional missile from the Black Sea, you know, over Turkey. And it's...
Who knows, one might land.
Just avoid those unfriendly skies would be right. The advice.
And the Russians are even teasing the Finns at the moment as well, aren't they? So they're really on a roll.
Indeed. Let's turn finally to censorship in Thailand. Another instance today, the local edition of the New York Times had an article omitted. On the front page, a story about a faltering economy and low public morale in Thailand was blanked out and left in its gaping hole on the front page, a short, blunt message. It said, "The article in this space was removed by our printer in Thailand. The International New York Times and its editorial staff had no role in its removal." Now, we've heard nothing from the local printing firm. They said nothing about it. Perhaps, you know, if censorship was the key objective, it's a rather clumsy way of doing it, because surely it draws more attention to the topic at hand.
It's almost like a Banksy approach to censorship, isn't it?
Quite, you know? Yeah.
Well, I'd have to say full credit to the New York Times for once in its life not being grey and actually, you know, you can't censor anymore. I mean, military... juntas tend to have lost sight of the fact. And, you know, whether it's people getting around it by tweeting out what would have been in the newspaper today, or the New York Times just, it's infinitely more devastating, I think, to anyone who's going to buy the International New York Times in Thailand. Who is that? Well, I mean, it'll be tourists. American tourists, not British tourists. It'll be tourists. It will be the business community based in Thailand, and, you know, certain highly westernized Thais, I assume. So rather than a detailed article, you get this, which is actually, this line is infinitely more devastating about, you know, the state of the government in relation to its own citizens, because they won't allow this to be published.
We've talked on this station before about the lack of, shall we say, PR acumen that the military junta has, given that they've brought several dissenting journalists in for, I think, I can't remember the euphemism to describe it, but it's kind of attitude readjustment training. I suppose they've got bigger fish to fry in terms of restoring the country to democracy. Is that their state? Is that their actual objective? Is another question. Perhaps should we be more sympathetic towards the junta, given that democracy in Thailand has essentially been a failure for the last 10 to 15 years?
It's been a very difficult history in terms of the democratic movement, but there has been quite a lot of protesting, and there has been a kind of a groundswell over the last 20 years. So I'd look at that in relatively optimistic terms. But yeah, like all military totalitarian kind of dictatorships, you know, rather stupid, and they don't have to be smart. You know, what are you going to do? They've got the guns.
Bizarre, really, isn't it, that just as Burma or Myanmar is coming in from the cold, Thailand is stepping into the freezer.
Yeah, well, it's not a country that I know very well, but I know what dictatorships look like, particularly military dictatorships, and I agree with Peter. You know, if it makes the boss feel good at the end of the day, that is often what goes into the decision-making process. And and it's entirely likely that, you know, if that's a way of asserting authority just to the Thai people they wish to rule, then that, who cares what people think?
Worth pointing out as well, another article blanked out in the New York Times was about the fading health of the King of Thailand, who holds great sway, and it'll be interesting to see what happens if or when he passes on. But there we'll have to leave the programme. Peter Fleming and Michael Goldfarb, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Clara Strunk. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. For the next half hour, Chris Chilvers will keep you company with Monocle's International Playlist. And at 1900 hours, it's Section D. That's with Henry Rhys Sheridan. At 2200, more current affairs on the Monocle Daily. This show's back at the same time tomorrow for this edition of Midori House. It's goodbye from me, Tighe Enright. Thank you very much for listening.